From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, how California's budget crisis has affected a program for the elderly and disabled and low incomes, plus why UC Davis helps mountain gorillas in Africa, and how homelessness isn't just a city problem. First, the United Nations Climate Conference in Copenhagen stalled today for a while when developing nations boycotted the talks. They want the world's rich nations, including the United States, to make much deeper cuts in their own greenhouse gas emissions. This is the start of the conference's second week. In a few days, more than 100 world leaders, including President Obama, are scheduled to arrive. A Sacramento man is at the conference. He's Daniel Jacobson, legislative director of the group Environment California, and he joins us from Copenhagen. Daniel Jacobson, welcome to Insight.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What did you make of the news earlier today that for a while, at least, developing nations were going to boycott the talks?
Well, certainly people were concerned, and the thing you have to keep in mind, though, is that right now, the Bella Center, which is a 15,000-person convention hall, has so many rumors that are flying around it that it's hard to keep track of them all. But this one really permeated to the top, and obviously if the countries were going to boycott, it was going to stall the efforts to get a treaty signed. But the good news is I think based in large part upon what Secretary Chu said today, it looks like everybody's back at the table.
Do you think the developing nations have a case that the richer nations of the world should be doing more to cut greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, they are certainly looking at what science tells us all has to happen. And you know, there's really two big issues that have been happening with the treaty since these talks started just last week. The first is, you know, can we cut the emissions from the biggest polluters? And the second is, can the biggest economies in the world financially help the developing countries to make sure that they're not using technologies that are going to promote more CO2? And it's those two discussions and it's those two issues and how we define that that's really taking up all the time at the treaty.
But one of the developing nations that was leading this temporary boycott was China, which is itself one of the biggest economies in the world. Where does China stand on this?
Well, I think just recently, and I was just looking at the BlackBerry before my call with you, and it seems as if they are now acknowledging that they, A, are going to have to cut, and they've been saying that for a long time, and B, that the concern that they had, I think, was that they wouldn't be receiving some money. And, I mean, again, apparently what the latest rumor is that they seem to be okay with that and saying that they'll be helping out some of the other countries.
So they kind of have a foot in both camps.
Yes, but I think that more people at the conference are seeing them as a, you know, have a very big foot in the large developed countries.
My guest is Daniel Jacobson. He's legislative director of Environment California, and he's in Copenhagen for the United Nations Climate Change Conference. What about the developing nations themselves, setting aside China? They want the rich countries of the world to do more to cut their greenhouse gas emissions. But are the developing countries of the world, in your opinion, doing enough themselves?
Well, they're a much smaller piece of the pie. And, you know, from everything that we've seen here in Copenhagen, all of the countries are doing something. I mean, including, you know, the United States, China, Brazil, India, you know, and even a lot of the smaller countries are all doing something. The question is it enough? And what we've been afraid of and what could happen here at the conference is anytime is if you get into the blame game of either you're not doing enough or you haven't done enough or you're not giving us enough money, that doesn't help the negotiations at all. And so at least from what I've seen from being here for the past week, is it tends to stall them out for a while and things have to close down sometimes for 2 days until people can sort of re-examine the issues. So while there are certain countries are saying, you know, well, we need more money and you need to cut more, and people will come back and say to them, well, you're not doing enough, you know, In essence, all of that's right. But what the real delegates have to do is look at it and say, look, all of us have to take a hit right now, both financially and in the work that we want to do to cut the amount of CO2 that's out there. And the kind of hit that they have to take is figuring out how do we reduce the amount of CO2. And that's the big issue that's on the table right now.
President Obama and other world leaders are going to be arriving later in the week. What can we expect out of this? What's your sense? Is it going to be just another big photo op with nice words but nothing meaningful coming out of it? Or do you see something more substantial coming out of this climate change conference?
I think something substantial will come out of it. The phrase that's been used here recently is that you're not going to bring 130 world leaders to Copenhagen and just get a photo op. People are going to want to see something more than that. And considering that 12 years ago when we had a similar conference in Kyoto and when the world looked to Kyoto and asked the single question of, are we going to solve global warming? And the answer was a resounding no. We have really run out of time. And the answer this time, I think, is going to be yes. Now, the question is that yes going to be enough? And, you know, that's hard to say right now. If I had to guess, I'd say it's not going to be everything that we need. It's not going to be what science tells us what we have to do. But I think it'll be a good framework to go into the next conference, which will be held in Mexico City.
Daniel Jacobson of Environment California. He's in Copenhagen for the UN Climate Change Conference. California's governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, is going to be speaking at the conference tomorrow. How do you think he is going to be received by other delegates at the conference?
I think he's going to be received in a very positive light, and the reason that I say that is because the message that we've been putting out for the past week plus that we've been here is a message that while Congress has been very slow to act, the United States is more than Congress. It's a federation of states. And when you look at what the states individually have been doing to combat global warming, we've been making real progress. And the governor is going to take that message to the delegates. Tomorrow is what they call Subnational Day, or what in the states we would call States Day. And he's going to be talking about the progress that not only California has made, but there's six states that have put caps on CO2. There's 29 states that have renewable energy standards. There's 14 states that have put tailpipe emission programs into practice. And if you add up all of those different programs around the states, you get really significant numbers in terms of what the United States has done. And it's not just a United States issue, but when we've talked to people from China and talked to their delegation, they're saying that their provinces are doing the same thing. Same with India, same with Brazil. And so there's an optimistic message, and I think that's what the governor's going to hit on, is that while global warming is a serious problem, and we have to take significant steps to do it right now, the good news is that if you look at what the subnationals have been doing, they've made a real down payment on solving this problem.
Are you seeing many protesters outside the conference?
Oh, yeah. And over the weekend, there were about 100,000 people that marched to the conference, this center, to urge the negotiators to get a fair, ambitious, and binding treaty. And then every day walking in, there's hundreds of people outside and, you know, really stating the case. I think the good news is that people aren't saying, you know, go home, but people are saying, let's make a deal. Let's help solve this problem.
And are there any countries or groups, either inside or outside the conference, that are saying, wait a second, we don't know how serious climate change is, or we do think it's serious, but we need to slow down whatever it is we're going to do because of the possible economic cost?
We haven't seen that. Now, again, some of the discussions are behind closed doors, and we're not able to get into those, but that has not been the case. You have not seen real doubters out here. People are saying it's a problem. What people will question is, what's the exact right solution? But nobody's going, global warming doesn't, you know, this isn't a problem. We think it's some kind of a made-up thing. People all agree with what the scientists are saying. This is a problem, and we have to solve it right now.
And finally, are there many others from California at the conference?
California is pretty well represented. There's a couple of other environmental groups here. There's a couple people from the state agencies that are over here. Obviously, the governor is coming. And I think a few members of our congressional delegation will be here. I think they either arrive today or will come in tomorrow.
I see. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Daniel Jacobson, Legislative Director of Environment California. He's in Copenhagen for the UN Climate Change Conference. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the impact of deep cuts on a program for California's low-income elderly and disabled. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Check us out on Facebook. Become one of our fans. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, what are the most important species on Earth? Science journalist Christopher Lloyd lists his top 100 in a book, and humans only make number 6. Find out which humble species is the planet's most successful on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. California has cut hundreds of millions of dollars from SSI, a program to help the state's low-income elderly and disabled. The impact of that cut is the subject of a two-part series by Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter Kelly Weiss. The first part aired this morning. Kelly's with us. Kelly, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Tell us a bit more about who is actually served by this program, SSI, or Supplemental Security Income.
So this is a program for, the first thing is that these individuals on the program are poor, they're very low income individuals, and they have a disability or they're over the age of 65. Those people are termed aged. So you're blind, disabled, or over 65, and you can get into the program. And how it works is they get a check each month. And in California, the average benefit for an individual who has a disability or is aged is now $845 a month.
It's quite a significant amount of money.
Yeah, well, it depends on how you look at it and who you ask. Experts who've studied the program have looked at how much it costs to live, because this check is for your housing, food, all of your bills, everything. And so a UCLA professor actually did a study and came up with an index on how much it costs to live. And he says to get a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco or Los Angeles, even Sacramento, you need $1,000 a month. So if you're getting $845, you don't even have enough for that apartment, is what many people argue. And there is data to show that.
How much has California cut from the program and why?
Well, as we probably are all aware, there's been an unprecedented state budget crisis. It's just ongoing here in California. And in the last year, SSI checks have been cut twice by lawmakers and Governor Schwarzenegger. And it's been cut by $25. Now, to us, that might not sound like a lot, but for many people, if they're barely getting by on that, you know, money that they have, that $25 cut is very significant, and it's actually the deepest budget cut to this program in the last decade, at least, that the state has made.
I'm talking with Kelly Weiss, Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter. Today, she started a two-part series on the impact of California's budget cuts on a program for the state's low-income elderly and disabled. It's SSI, Supplemental Security Income. Kelly, give us an example of someone you talked with.
Sure. Well, this morning we heard from a woman named Tina Reedinger. She's 61, and she's been on the SSI program for about 15 years. She has severe mental illness, and she lives in an apartment, a subsidized apartment in downtown Sacramento. But one of her biggest struggles is food. She says she eats one meal a day, that's all she can do. And it's from Meals on Wheels, so it's even a free meal. But her concern is now with this $25 cut that she's not going to be able to even keep her apartment. And we'll hear from Reedinger now.
Sometimes I have even fallen out of bed because I think I'm running away from some man who's trying to get me because I'm living under the bridge. You know, where do I go from here? I'm getting good help here. I have friends here. But what happens if all that goes away? And then sometimes in my mind, I can't keep those thoughts away.
Now, you also spoke with people who are service providers for people like Tina who are getting SSI money.
Yes, that's right. And so Reedinger's fear is that she's going to become homeless. For many seniors on the SSI program, they already are homeless. And I traveled to Los Angeles to the biggest emergency shelter in Los Angeles. It is quite big. And spoke with the program director at this shelter called the New Image Emergency Shelter. They did a survey and found that a growing number of seniors are showing up, and a third of them have SSI checks. And Jim Ebert, again, the program director at this shelter, is, you know, told me what he's seen when they're coming in.
There is an abundance. I see abundance of sadness, of shame, of disbelief when a newly homeless senior adult walks in this door. I see their eyes are down. There's no joy in this walk. It's a hard acceptance. And I feel as if in a country so great, how can we allow this to happen? And then when you really get to know the person and know how they have participated in your community, maybe being a veteran, maybe being somebody who works in the post office, maybe somebody who works in your local hospital, or, you know, they had great jobs that enhanced people's lives, and now for one reason or another, they're now homeless, and this is their lot.
Now, earlier we heard from a woman who doesn't have a lot of money, but at least she has a place right now. But you also spoke with a man who's blind and homeless.
That's right. His name is Leroy Mapp, and he's 55 years old. As you said, blind, homeless. He also says he has schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and he has, chronically homeless. He's staying at the New Image Shelter, and he is very concerned about the cuts to his check. And here's what he told me at the New Image Emergency Shelter.
So what shall she do about that? A lot of people can't afford that. A lot of people is visually impaired. A lot of people is paraplegic. A lot of people is crazy as hell. You know, so they need their money. So how can the governor do it like that? That ain't right. I don't think it's right, because we need every dime we can get.
We're talking about the impact of California's budget cuts on SSI, Supplemental Security Income. It's a program that's meant to help people who are low-income elderly and or disabled, and Capital Public Radio reporter Kelly Weiss is covering this issue this week on our station. Obviously, these people seem like they really need the money, and there's not a whole lot of money in the first place, and it's been cut. How do we know that SSI works at all?
Well, that's a good point, Jeffrey, and I want to mention something about Leroy Mapp, who we just heard from. We heard about his multiple disabilities. He also says that he is an alcoholic, and this gets to the point of SSI and its efficacy or adequacy. Leroy Mapp says he takes his check and, you know, uses some of that money to buy alcohol, and he says in the past he's bought drugs. Now, this leads to the fact of, is SSI working? Many argue that it's not enough money, but there's something else to this, and that is that once the check goes out the door from the state, the federal government kicks in money too, but the state supplements. They spend $3 billion a year on this program at the state in general fund money. And then Leroy Mapp gets that check, and nobody looks at how he's spending it. So this is what we're going to look at tomorrow in the series. And when you bring this up to the director of the Department of Social Services, he oversees the state's portion of SSI. You know, officials are very defensive about the fact that this money isn't supposed to have strings attached. Cash assistance, he says people should be able to spend it on housing and food, but he doesn't know how they're spending it, again, because no one's tracking it. And the director of the Department of Social Services, California's Department of Social Services, John Wagner, and here's him responding to the question of, is this working? How do you know how the money is spent?
So it's difficult to say, what do you get for the $3 billion. I think what we get is a certain amount of income to individuals and couples that is part of our safety net in California.
What about lawmakers? You spoke with some?
Yes, I did speak with some lawmakers, and I spoke with Republican State Senator Abel Maldonado, also in the news recently as Governor Schwarzenegger's tapped him to be lieutenant governor. He is the vice chair of California's Human Services Committee. That committee oversees SSI and several other social programs. Maldonado does say that, you know, the budget cuts to this program will save the state $700 million this fiscal year. He wasn't in support of those cuts, but, you know, he can understand where the state needs to save money. His concern is that this money isn't being tracked, and he wants to know, what is the state getting for this money? We need to figure it out. And so when I spoke with Maldonado, he said he wants to look into it, and we'll hear from him now.
We need to reform the system, look into the system to prevent the waste, fraud, and abuse of a few, to keep the program going and to keep it solvent. I like the program. I think people that that need the resources should receive it. Now, I don't think we ought to, you know, look at the program to try to make some changes drastically because of a few are abusing it. But we need to look at it, and I'm one for looking at it.
The cuts to SSI in California were a result of the state's budget crisis, and the state's budget crisis hasn't gone away. The state's budget is still completely off. There's a big deficit to be bridged. Do we know what's going to happen next year to SSI?
Well, there is concern by many advocates that this program could once again see cuts. They've, you know, SSI checks have seen repeated and ongoing cuts. How it works is the state is in an agreement with the federal government that they will fund the program to a certain point. If they cut too deeply, they'll jeopardize billions of dollars in federal funding for other programs. So the program will be maintained at a base level, but there's still room to cut. I don't know what's going to happen, but they, by law, can still make some budget cuts. So depending on how big the shortfall is, perhaps it could see more cuts.
Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter Kelly Weiss this morning. We heard the first of her two-part series on the impact of California's budget cuts on SSI, Supplemental Security Income. It's a program for the state's low-income elderly and disabled. Tomorrow, we will hear the second part, correct?
Yes, that's right.
What time is it? 6:30, 8:30?
That's right.
Great. Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, two baby mountain gorillas that UC Davis cares for are now back home in the Congo. We'll get an update from their veterinarian in Rwanda. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more about the people and topics in our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Tomorrow, a computer game about figuring out the minimum healthcare coverage that people should have. It involves negotiation, compromise, and consensus building. Plus, a local professor says cows and pigs don't harm the climate as much as vegetarians claim. Also, applications are opening for people who want to be considered for California's redistricting commission. And local smooth jazz saxophonist Charlie Langer will listen to music from his new album. Two baby mountain gorillas under the care of UC Davis are now back home in the Congo. Why were the young gorillas away from home in the first place? How are they doing now? And what does UC Davis have to do with all this? We've got several guests to discuss this, including a veterinarian who's based in Rwanda. But we'll start with, in our studio, Kirsten Gilardi, who's co-director of the Mountain Gorilla One Health Program at the Wildlife Health Center at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Kirsten, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
What does UC Davis have to do with mountain gorillas in Africa?
That's a great question. Actually, UC Davis has quite a long legacy of involvement with mountain gorillas. Few people know that Diane Fossey was an undergraduate at UC Davis before she studied mountain gorillas, and everybody knows that she brought mountain gorillas to the world's awareness. As well, we have mountain gorilla researchers Sandy Harcourt, Kelly Stewart are both members of the Department of Anthropology, and they were researchers with mountain gorillas with Diane Fossey. The Wildlife Health Center, we focus on wildlife and their environment and the threats to their health that are brought about by their interactions with humans and with other domestic animals. And so for us, this was really an opportunity to partner with what we believe is a really a model program for wildlife conservation in the world. And so we're thrilled to be a part of it.
These two baby mountain gorillas that have been returned to the Congo, why were they taken away from the Congo?
They were unfortunately infants in a group that was attacked and killed by people. And so they were without their parents and were brought into captivity to be cared for.
Attacked and for food?
No, not for food. Unfortunately, it's complicated, but they were attacked as sort of a power play, really.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot more to that, but it seems odd to be killing gorillas as part of a power play between two tribes.
It was really between workers in the park, and it is complicated. There's quite a bit of criminal activity that occurs in that area, not just the war, but also illegal entries into the park for charcoal production. And so it was an unfortunate, they were really caught in the crossfire, literally.
We're talking about baby mountain gorillas under the care of UC Davis and an affiliated nonprofit, the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project. The baby gorillas have just been returned to their home in the Congo. Joining us from the field is Jan Raymer, regional veterinary manager in Rwanda for the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project. She's in charge of the place that received the orphaned baby mountain gorillas. She joins us via Skype. There's a short delay. Jan Raymer, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Jan, tell us about these gorillas. How old are they? How were they doing? And why was it time to return them?
Well, they are both between 3 years old. And we're living in Goma in the where they were very well cared.
Sounds like we're having problems with our connection. So let's bring in our third guest, who's also with us by phone, Mike Cranfield, who's co-director of the Mountain Gorilla One Health Program at the Wildlife Health Center, and he's executive director of the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, which is affiliated with UC Davis. Mike, welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much. I think what Jan was trying to say is that they were in an emergency center because there was no, this was kind of unexpected, and there was no place built for them that was very appropriate. And they actually lived in a regular home that was beside, it was quite a noisy, hot, dusty neighborhood with a hotel in that overlooked the backyard. So it was totally, by an airport, so it was totally inappropriate for these baby mountain gorillas. But they did do fairly well under the 24-hour care of the Congolese caregivers and the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project veterinarians. And then the Canadian Friends of MGVP came up with the money to build a forest sanctuary or location where there's a beautiful area that's near the park where they would be eating natural food and doing natural behavior. So it's just been wonderful pleasure to move them there.
How did you find the gorillas in the first place?
Well, as Kirsten said, it was a political nightmare, actually, because there was about 8 animals killed, and it was a political move over some illegal charcoal movement and one group trying to blame another group for this atrocity. And basically, one of the trackers found them and then found the two babies and brought the babies in through the night. And we were able to meet him in a local town and then nurse them back to health, and now they're just doing wonderfully.
Let's try one more time with the connection with Jan Raymer, who's in Rwanda. Jan, tell us what it was like caring for these two young gorillas.
What I can tell you is that when we moved them to Sinkwekwe, the new center, it would be almost cried without interest and closure.
No, I think we'll have to give up on the connection to Rwanda. We're not able to hear enough from Jan. Mike, you were in Rwanda not too long ago.
I was actually in the truck with the gorillas when they moved.
Tell us
it was a great day.
Yeah, tell us what it was like working with them.
We planned this for quite a while because there's obviously all kinds of things that could go wrong during a move like that. But we planned with the ICCN military and with their conservation people. And we had a truck that was basically caged to carry troops safely in the back with a tarp over it. And the baby gorillas are phenomenally playful. And this truck was parked in their in the backyard where they lived, and they got used to it climbing in and out of it and had absolutely no fear of the truck when they got in for the final move. And it just all went very, very well. And I think what was fascinating to me is that these animals were taken when they're 6 months, actually 3 months of age, and they were let loose in this enclosure, and one looked around very curiously at the bushes and everything else, and not ever having seen a banana tree before, it went over and pulled down this young banana tree and started eating the inside of the banana pulp, which is exactly what they would do in the wild. And you just go, how the heck did he know that tree from another tree? It's just amazing.
How do you know they're going to be okay? I mean, obviously they figured out the banana thing, but generally speaking, how do you know they'll be okay?
Well, they're doing well, and they're on forest food. We go out and collect forest food for them, and they're developing absolutely normal behavior, and basically they play together unless they're nervous or scared, and then they'll run to their caregivers. So their caregivers are much like the adults would be in the wild. So their behavior is perfectly normal, and it's interesting because people in the past have never been able to really raise them, and gorillas, more so than chimpanzees, sort of get depressed unless they have tremendous attention. So our caregivers work with them 24 hours a day, and until they're about a year and a half old, they actually sleep with the gorillas at night too.
Kirsten Gilardi, will the gorillas ever be able to live in the wild like regular gorillas?
Well, that's, of course, the million-dollar question. And unfortunately, they're not the only orphan mountain gorillas that we're caring for. We're also caring for three other mountain gorillas and several eastern lowland gorilla orphans. And that is the big question, whether they'll be able to go back to the wild. And past attempts to return orphans to the wild have not been successful. The thought now is that if animals get to the age at which they would naturally disperse or leave their family group, because they're maturing and it's time for them to go find a new group, that might be the time to consider putting these animals in the wild. But there are many, many questions about that, whether they are capable of taking care of themselves in the wild is really what needs to be determined. And so that it really ends, ultimately, it's a question for the governments to answer. And, of course, the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project will do whatever we can to support their decision-making on that.
Mike Cranfield, is there any way to know whether or not the gorillas actually want to go and live in the wild?
That's a tough call, because these two in particular were taken away when they were so young that they would have very little memory of the wild. But the way they're taking to the trees and building night nests and behaving like wild gorillas, it sure seems like they would love to be back there.
Are there many other mountain gorillas that you know of in Rwanda, the Congo, that area, that are in a similar situation as these two young gorillas were when they were very young? In other words, in danger.
There's about 380 in the park that they came from, 380 gorillas. And hopefully, these will be the last ones that will be orphaned. And that will mean that we have four in captivity, and the two others will be joining these two probably in the next few months. And then decisions will be made as this group grows up in a group of four.
And Kirsten Gilardi, you and Mike are co-directors of the Mountain Gorilla One Health program at UC Davis. What does that mean, One Health?
One Health is really a term we use to describe the connectedness between the health of animals and the health of people and the environment they're living in, and that interface, that it's all interconnected, and that efforts to ensure the health of wildlife populations really do depend on ensuring the health of the other animals they share that environment with, as well as the people that they share that environment with. And so for years, the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project has not just been caring for mountain gorillas in the wild, but also taking steps to ensure that the people who are protect the gorillas in the wild. The people who care for the orphans are also healthy, and their families are healthy. And so UC Davis, as the veterinary school at UC Davis, has been kind of at the national forefront of efforts to link animal health and human health programs. And so for us, this was really a natural fit to partner with the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project and help build out some of these One Health programs, because we can pull in the expertise of not only our faculty at the veterinary school, but also faculty at the School of Medicine, the world's experts in agriculture. And so it's really a pretty wonderful home for the program, and together we're going to be able to do some really wonderful things, we think, for the communities that surround the parks where the mountain gorillas live.
And Mike Cranfield, finally, what about the people who, have been going after the mountain gorillas, harming them, killing them? Are the governments of Rwanda, the Congo, are they going after those people?
Absolutely. There are punishments. They are placed in jail and they're fined. But the long-term deal is going to be more of an educational process. And the orphans that are in the very nice sanctuary now, there's going to be a platform for the local people to be able to come up and watch them, because 99% of the local people have never seen mountain gorillas, and I think that they'll fall in love with them once they have a chance to see how closely their behavior and their actions are to people. I think that it's just winning the people over. I mean, they are getting some benefit from having the mountain gorillas around because of tourism, and the tourism brings schools and hospitals and things. But for them to actually connect with the animals, I think, will be very important.
That's Mike Cranfield. He's executive director of the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project. It's a nonprofit organization that's affiliated with UC Davis, and together they run the Mountain Gorilla One Health program. Mike and Kirsten Gilardi of UC Davis, who's in our studio, are co-directors of the One Health program. We also spoke a little bit with Jan Raymer, who's regional veterinary manager in Rwanda for the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project. We tried to talk with her via Skype, but there was a big delay and a lot of breakup. But anyway, we thank Jan for being available. We thank everyone for talking with us today on Insight.
Thank you, Jeff.
Great. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, homelessness in rural areas. How big is the problem? What services are there? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight streams live online. Check it out at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, Sacramento County trying to get money to restore medical exams for young, abused or neglected children. Plus, Placerville considers whether to extend its moratorium on thrift stores. And demand at California's food banks is up 30 to 50% this year. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered. When you hear news stories about the homeless, it's usually about people in a city. But there are a lot of homeless people in rural areas too. But those places tend to have fewer government-provided social services. And when those areas are in the foothills and the mountains, they tend to be much colder in the winter. We're going to talk now about the scale of homelessness in rural areas, the special challenges it poses, and what services are available to help. We have guests from several areas in the vicinity of the Sacramento area. We're going to start with Cindy Maple, who's Executive Director of Hospitality House, a shelter for the homeless in Western Nevada County. Cindy, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Can you give us some idea of the number of homeless people in your area?
Well, we just did a homeless count in January of this year, and we were actually able to, we did it what's called an incentive-based event, where the goal was to draw homeless people into the event, and we completed about 100 surveys on site, homeless folks there. We also did a county agency, a nonprofit event, or count, I should say, on that day. We had teams of counselors that went out into the community, which, of course, is a difficult challenge for us because we're in such a forested area that the camps are pretty difficult to find. With that count, we came up with about 250 people that we were able to count, and with HUD methodology, you can essentially pretty much double that number. And our numbers and the numbers of people that we're seeing each year also corresponds with that.
So that's about 500 people you're estimating homeless in Nevada County, which is of course, a relatively small population county.
Yes.
Also with us is, in our studio, Art Edwards, president of United Outreach of El Dorado County. Art, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey. I appreciate it.
What about El Dorado County? Do you have an estimate of the number of homeless people there?
We have taken counts, but as previous speaker said, homeless people tend to not want to be identified for various reasons. They're usually sleeping in illegal places, for one. The counts we have, very similar to what she said, around 250 we've counted in any given night. But the more accurate count we have gotten is from the school district in our area, who has told us that there are over 440 children in the entire county who are homeless.
Also with us by phone, Mike Manshart of the Yuba City Group Hands of Hope, Resources for Homeless Families. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good morning.
What about in your area? Do you have a count or an estimate of the number of homeless people in the Yuba-Sutter County area?
Yes. I want to strongly affirm what both of the previous speakers said, that the HUD methodology requires us to miss so many people. We have a point-in-time estimate of around 300 individuals who are homeless in the Yuba-Sutter area, but in the same way as previously, our school count, the McKinney-Vento count, indicates that we have 500 children homeless by the federal standard in Yuba and Sutter counties.
And we, for a national perspective, Steve Berg joins us of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. He's Vice President for Programs and Policy. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What about nationally speaking? Do we have a percentage, a number for the number of homeless who live in rural areas?
Well, I don't think there's any national numbers that are really dead set reliable. It's not a huge percentage, but it's a part of the population that, as the other speakers have said, it's very difficult to get a handle on how many people there are, and very difficult to find people and get them the services they need. So it's something we're concentrating on, especially.
Okay. Now, services are spotty in some cases in rural areas. The counties tend to be smaller population. They tend to be more spread out. Cindy Maple, in Western Nevada County, you do have a shelter for the homeless, Hospitality House, where you're executive director. But I note that it's a nomadic homeless shelter. What does that mean?
What that means is that we partner with approximately 25 different faith communities. And we have a welcome center, which is our check-in center. And it means that we load our guests up every single night on a bus and go to a different faith community that hosts us for the evening. And the reason that we did that is when we first started planning for our shelter, there was absolutely zero zoning for emergency shelters in Nevada County. And so we had been tracking what Placer County was doing in developing a nomadic shelter. And also, I had been tracking an incident that occurred in Sacramento where there was an issue over some homeless people sleeping on the steps of a church. And what we learned is that churches are exempt from zoning law. So we began our nomadic shelter, which actually, you know, ended up being a wonderful, wonderful thing for our community because when we started, there was practically zero awareness that there were any homeless in Nevada County at all because they stay so well hidden. And so, you know, it really brought to light the problem in this county, and it allowed us to, you know, just build a partnership like
yes.
none other.
Art Edwards in El Dorado County, as I understand, the county currently doesn't have a formal shelter. What happened?
That's right. They've never had a formal shelter that I know. In fact, as the woman said, we had same issues with them. Everyone, including the county, denied that there was such a thing as a homeless problem in our county up until a year ago, when people began to realize that their fact was a problem, is a problem, the county board supervisors has come around now and has given us, United Outreach, a piece of property, 3.5 acres, $1 a year lease for 20 years, and there are 3 homes on it, which we're going to turn into a homeless shelter. It's taking a while. We need money. We have none, virtually. We're going to develop them into homeless places to live for families. But right now, no, the county has nothing ongoing that to help the homeless people.
Mike Manshart, what about in Yuba and Sutter counties? Do you have a shelter?
Right now, Hands of Hope is operating a day service center for homeless families. We provide showers, laundry, clothing closet, homework support, compassionate listening, but that, of course, is daytime. In cooperation with the city of Yuba City and a number of other providers, we have, just as Cindy has described, we are 36 hours away from opening our first rotating shelter in the community, where we'll be able to house up to 24 individuals over the next several months on an evening-by-evening basis.
Steve Berg at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. It's got to be a specific challenge for smaller counties that are particularly spread out, getting together the resources, either from the government or from the community, to provide shelters.
Well, it really is true, and that's why, I mean, one of the things we know about homelessness in rural areas, for example, is there's a lot more families with children than in cities as a percentage, and those families with children are much more likely to be unsheltered than they are in cities. You very seldom, with some exceptions, Los Angeles is the biggest exception, but in most cities, you don't see families with children living on the streets or living in their cars. But in rural areas, you see a lot of that. Now, what a lot of rural areas have done, instead of trying to, the shelter is not necessarily the be-all and end-all here. I mean, a lot of rural areas have adopted rapid rehousing programs, for example, where if somebody shows up homeless, they quickly get them into an apartment, rather than trying that, which is easier than building a shelter. It's also true that in a lot of rural areas, there just aren't very many programs at all of any sort. So we have quite a mix of situations.
Art, El Dorado County is a sprawling county, and like in many rural counties, there's poverty, but there's also a lot of affluence in El Dorado County. Doesn't the county have the financial resources to be able to do more?
No, I'm not an expert on the finances of the county, but they keep telling us that they don't. They did provide a few $100s for us a couple of years ago, but since then, apparently, everything has collapsed financially in the county. And we're just a part of that collapse. We get our money, what we can get, comes from local churches and nonprofits and corporations and just people. The county itself has apparently no money to give us, at least that's what they say. So we're floundering.
Cindy Maple in Nevada County, you start off in the foothills, but Nevada County extends well and truly up into the mountains. Surely winter weather is a particular problem for the homeless in Nevada County.
Yes, it is. Actually, we have a number of snow days, and our county does extend into Truckee. And, it's particularly difficult for folks, most especially because we can't offer 24-hour services. And so we do have a period of time where folks are forced to be out in the snow for 5 hours. I mean, we scramble and we try to get volunteers in, and we're usually successful on snow days, but our buses don't run, and we also don't even have public transit on the weekends at all. So there are very few places for people to escape the weather. And the other thing is that because we are so spread out, there are a lot of folks that may not even know hospitality houses exist. I had a person that came in one time from North San Juan that had been camping in the snow, and he said he woke up and he literally had icicles on his beard.
Mike Manshart, Yuba and Sutter are more urban counties than El Dorado and Nevada. Anything special to your situation, your county's homelessness situation that we haven't talked about with the other two counties?
Well, we do have a mix of people who are literally sleeping behind dumpsters and along the riverbanks. But I think the issues with those folks are really the same. They're very short on services, and a particular problem is transportation. Even if families are very interested in coming to us to receive day services or to participate in the overnight shelter, they have to get all the way to our facility, and that's been a severe impediment for a lot of them.
And Steve Berg at the National Alliance to End Homelessness, we just have about a minute left. A final thought from you?
On a real challenge here, and I think what we've found is that in some of the rural areas that are getting the best results, they're using sort of homegrown solutions, right? Again, the building a shelter isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all. There's a lot of communities don't have shelters but are still able to get people back into housing very quickly. So that's really the question to look at, is how to get people back into some sort of housing so they're not living outside, where a lot of people in rural areas, a lot of homeless people are living outside, and that's just has to be not acceptable.
Yes. That's Steve Berg, Vice President of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. We've been talking about rural homelessness. Mike Manshart is President of the Yuba City Group, Hands of Hope, Resources for Homeless Families. Art Edwards is President of United Outreach of El Dorado County. And Cindy Maple is Executive Director of Hospitality House, a shelter for the homeless in Western Nevada County. If you go to our website, capradio.org/insight, you'll find links to more information about each of those groups. But I will note that Hospitality House has its fourth annual Night of Giving holiday concert on the evening of December 19th. It's at Miner's Foundry in Nevada City. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Miranda Fox, Jason Kanger, and Mara Ponce. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer, Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.